Hello, reader. You're plugged in to another episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. We hope you enjoy it.
Hi, I'm Mila de Villiers. Welcome to today's episode of PageCast, Jonathan Ball's weekly podcast episode, where we discuss all things books by their authors. Today will be Ted Buerta. Welcome, Ted.
Thanks very much for having me.
Today we're chatting about Ted's latest, Hollywood on the Felt, when movie mayhem gripped the City of Gold. Ted, firstly, what's it like being back in the City of Gold?
Do you ever leave the City of Gold, Tay? I love Joburg, and I think it's so full of stories and such a vibe. I mean, people always talk about the vibe, and it's very difficult to explain. But boy, as soon as you land, it's there. And, you know, I guess it. Some people relate to it and some people just don't get it, but I love it.
Now, speaking of stories, this is some story that you wrote. If you could describe the main character of your book, Isidore I.W. Schlesinger, in 5 words, what would they be?
Visionary, tyrannical, difficult, rich, and South Africa loving.
On the latter, how did it come to be that this Jewish American, who ostensibly was a property bro at first, became this media mogul in South Africa?
So, I mean, it has really to do with the history of Joburg and what was happening in the entertainment. And people might not know this today, but Joburg was this huge entertainment mecca, which largely had to do with gold and miners having a lot of money, and they needed some form of entertainment. And so from the earliest days, 1886, I mean, there was all kinds of entertainment available in Joburg. So it was roller skating rinks and boxing tournaments, and Turfontein was one of the first places to open, brothels, hotels, bars, and theaters played a mass, and circuses, of course, and theaters played a major, major role, and they brought out vaudeville and musicals and plays and everything from overseas, and they always had the best productions. But the problem there was that they were building up these incredible expenses to bring out these massive companies of actors and all their equipment and sometimes orchestras and put them up at hotels. And, you know, so an individual theater to bear all these costs, it started weighing on them. And by 1913, you had the introduction of movies coming out of America and Europe. And so these theaters had to suddenly make more money available for these movies. And people kind of wanted more and more and more. It's like today, people can't get enough of the internet and something new. And so this was their version of that. And with that expense, these theaters started going bankrupt. And they need somebody to save them. And the bank said, well, it's not really us who can save you, and you owe us the money. And so they approached Schlesinger. And so Schlesinger, who loved a great deal, if he could get a business for cheap, and it was in trouble, even though he knew nothing about it and he knew nothing about entertainment, he bought into it. But I mean, his raison d'etre for the industry was like, he wanted to buy all of the theaters, bring them under one roof, cut his overheads, and like move on from there. And so that's what he did. He bought as many theaters as he could and started his empire in 1913.
And he was a gambler, so he took quite a gamble there too.
Well, I mean, he was a gambler in not the real gambling sense, because he didn't like gambling. He liked a risk, but like I say in the book, he liked a risk that he knew the outcome of, where he would be the winner.
And winner he certainly was.
Yeah, definitely.
Also, it's interesting to me how he's often described as a little man, but also he's all about excess and more and more and more. Do you think he low-key had a Napoleon complex of sorts and just compensated for that?
Well, you know, it's like people ask me about Daisy, do I know why she murdered people? I mean, I had no idea why she murdered people, you know, that she took to the gallows with her. And with Schlesinger as well, he was a very difficult person to research because there was very little written about him because he was publicity averse. So it was kind of connecting the dots over many years that I was doing research. And I think you know, I don't think it had anything to do with him being little. Maybe it did. He was like 5'2", which was quite strange in that Hollywood producers of the time, there were two others who were the same height as him, who became some of the most famous producers in history. And I don't know, maybe it's something in that, you know, maybe the Napoleonic thing drives them. But he clearly had this drive to be successful. And even though he loved this, create a world of excess of entertainment in Joburg, he also was very careful about his money. You know, I think the entertainment industry was his one. Now, he had, like I say in the book, he had many, many companies, real estate, agriculture, farms, advertising, so many things. But this was the one sector of his businesses that really didn't make money, was when he started making movies. His theaters made money, but his movies was the one thing that never really made money. So it was kind of counterintuitive for him to spend time and effort on this industry that actually didn't pay off in the end. So there was, I think he developed this kind of passion for movie making that kind of was unexplainable.
And I mean, speaking of farms now, Killarney, which now is a neighborhood in Joburg, with cool Art Deco buildings and such, but that was his farm back in the day. Can you just try and create an image of what Killarney looked like back then in the early 1900s?
Well, I mean, if one can imagine, it was apparently farmland. It was called Cook's Estate before it was called Killarney, and there were orchards and a little stream with a bridge over it and a couple of buildings on it. When he bought it in 1906, with lots of felt in all directions, you know, now you've got the N1 running through it and the hospital on the hill and lots of things that weren't there. So you can imagine this open landscape with a couple of mansions on the Parktown Ridge. So, I mean, and that was the area that he started making movies on. So these running battles of thousands of people that you see in these two spectacle movies that he made at Killarney, I mean, that would have been happening there. So, I mean, it's quite amazing to think that all these like battle scenes and when he's like pieces of the Anglo-Zulu War, like Rorke's Drift, where he built buildings to copy Rorke's Drift, that all happened in that area, which is now all built up today. But I think it's interesting that if you think Los Angeles is probably exactly the same, where Hollywood was just farmland and there were just shacks and barns, which they used as their film producing areas. And today it's, you know, I mean, you would never recognize it.
And he had a propensity to emulate that was happening in America. He enjoyed copying.
Yeah, he was a big copier. I mean, I think, you know, coming from America, he came out in 1894 and he started selling insurance, started his real estate company, and any idea that would work in America, he would bring back to South Africa. And he saw South Africa as a kind of a copy of America, but a very similar landscape, same climate, especially in the California area. So he thought, well, an idea that works in America is going to work in South Africa. And to a large extent, he was correct. And then when movies came along, he started copying the movie industry in America, which I don't know if a lot of people know this, but which was only starting at that time. I mean, Hollywood was, as I say, farmland. It wasn't a well-known name like it is today. And so that's the incredible thing that he did, was he copied an industry that was really in its infancy in America. And he kind of tried to match them, in, you know, blow for blow for the next like 6-7 years. And it's a story that's not known, which I tell in the story in the book, and it's quite incredible.
And we thank you for that. Also, in The Fall of the Empire, you write, this opening sentence is, it all began quite fittingly with a death. Can you just elaborate on that sentence in relation to the Great Strike, winning a continent, or De Voortrekkers, and the symbol of sacrifice, with its fairly prophetic nature of death?
Yes. So the two big movies that he made within like the first 3-4 years of opening up his movie production studio was, the one was the Voortrekker movie, The Winning a Continent, which was a great trek, and The Blood River. And the second one was the Anglo-Zulu War, which was called symbol of sacrifice. And for these, he had massive battle sequences. He had sets made, you know, and there was like no movies like that had really been made anywhere in the world with such numbers, such outdoor sequences. You know, people were used to shooting in studios and they had these painted black back canvases of a mountain, and that would be Switzerland. And, you know, you'd have these, everything was kind of fake. And even when they filmed outdoors, they would say, oh, well, this is California. And it actually was just around the corner from them. And, you know, it was so, but Schlesinger really wanted verisimilitude, which is kind of everything to be the real thing. I mean, he got stuck with that because it turned out to be very, very expensive, especially when you have to translocate thousands of people and equipment. And when he did the Anglo-Zulu War, yeah, everything had to go down to Natal. But he was like doing everything from scratch. He knew nothing about film production. And so like accidents would happen. And so on both movie productions, there were accidents, there were deaths. And I sometimes think he was a little bit jinxed on his movies because, these things kept happening after these two spectacles were made. But if you think in retrospect, the size and spectacle of his movies and the ignorance of everyone who's involved because they were really doing something new, it's quite amazing that more accidents didn't happen. I mean, if you look at video footage, which is very rare, of battle sequences in the Anglo-Zulu War movie, it's actually spectacular. I mean, the shot is taken from a ridge and you look down into the valley and there are literally thousands of people coming from both sides and they clash. I mean, I just don't know how people didn't die in that, or like massive injuries and casualties. And so you're talking about the death of the Empire. So the Empire was the very first theater, always like it became his base. It was the first theater that he bought in Joburg on Commissioner Street. And it became a kind of a base before he built his studio. And the death was, of course, the death of the Empire, of the entertainment empire and the Empire Theatre itself, and the beginning of his new industry that he was starting.
Which started with The Great Strike, a bunch of new segments.
Yeah, irony about, kind of, I don't know whether it was fortuitous or what, but he started his entertainment empire right at South Africa was in this very rebellious, volatile, fractious state. You know, it was shortly after Union, not long after the Boer War, unhappy truce, Afrikaners and English against each other, unhappy miners, both black and white, strikes all over Johannesburg regularly. And he bought his first theater at the same time that the Kleinfontein miners' strike was going on, which was a huge, huge strike, which is the biggest one that would come along before 1922. And that was when he started making his news segments, and he actually sent out his cameramen to shoot the strike. And one of them died during the shooting. He was shot during the shooting of the documentary. I mean, of the news footage. So he sank his teeth right into the subject immediately.
Interesting that you mentioned documentary, because many people regard Nanook of the North as the first official documentary, yet here Schlesinger was documenting history.
Yeah, so I mean, it's fascinating for me that he, at the same time that he was, and this is something that they weren't doing in America or anywhere really, a person who was making film productions was also making newsreels. I mean, they were two very separate entities, and he was actually bringing them together under one roof. And so his cameramen were actually shooting features and newsreels at the same time. They were like juggling the two. And he would go out and he would shoot, the word documentary doesn't exist until 1926. So this is way before then. So you have these newsreels that start getting longer and longer and longer. And he sent out his cameramen by 1918, 19, they were going out doing longer documentaries to an island near Antarctica, to Madagascar, to East Africa, to Ruwenzori's in Central Africa. So he was doing these kind of crazy, factual pictures, which were way ahead of their time.
And now that you mention this combination of, say, news and history, you also create a sense of it's a very evocative read. Yet this is nonfiction. How do you go about like it reads like a novel at times even. How do you go about creating the settings, the characters, the scene, the atmosphere?
I think, you know, when I write something like this, like when I was writing Days to Melka, it's, you want to kind of keep the reader entranced all the time without becoming too heavy on the facts and like the technicalities of it, and to bring somebody who doesn't really know a lot about the movie industry in this case into the whole thing and explain, this is why this is important, this is why this is interesting, this is what was happening in America and England at the time, this was this world back then that many have forgotten, and it's like really interesting. And it's, how do I tell this in a relatable fashion and make it kind of story-ish? And yeah, I mean, that was foremost in my mind when I was writing as well, to keep kind of the pace going like a good movie.
Hey, look at you. So meta.
Yeah.
Also, interestingly enough, he carried on making movies during the First World War.
Yeah, I mean, his newsmen went up to East Africa, so they went up to British, German East Africa, and they were shooting up there. They went to Southwest Africa, and actually, they carried on during the Second World War, and there was a film studio, a news film reels run out of Killarney, even though he'd stopped proper film production by then. I mean, the newsreel kept going for the next, it ran for about 60, 70 years altogether. So they even did like some propaganda for the British during the Second World War. You know, I mean, that was done all over the place. That was done by famous directors like David Lean. And, you know, they all got involved in kind of the war effort. I think they did some shooting in I guess it would be Borneo, Java area. They kind of didn't shy away from some serious footage. And of course, then the famous one that they did shoot that no one has ever seen is the Bullhook Massacre in 1921 down near Queenstown. And when Pastor Enoch Mgajima had led his followers in this crusade, and they clashed with the police and the army, and 200 people died. And one of Schlesinger's cameramen had like sneaked into the area, and he got footage. And when it was before it was able to be shown, the government made them like not show it, and they destroyed all the copies. So, I mean, it's kind of, you know, shooting real news back then, it's not like today. It's like not people going into war zones. It was kind of unusual. I mean, they went into the Boer War. That became the first playground for cameramen shooting a war, but it was kind of the exception. And so going out to do something like the Bullhook Massacre, it was quite unusual and quite controversial. And so those are always interesting aspects of Schlesinger for me, because he was a micromanager of note. So he would have had a finger in every one of these decisions. Like, nobody would have gone as a cameraman to Bullhook without him knowing about it. Or any of the other things, like going off to an island near Antarctica or to Madagascar or wherever. So it always kind of is in the back of my mind, this guy was really interesting in that he like knew no boundaries. Like, he would try anything.
Is that what most draws you to him?
I think what drew me in originally was the fact that he was an American making movies in South Africa in an era when I didn't know there was a movie industry in South Africa. And I mean, just like as I started digging away, the story became bigger and bigger and bigger about what he'd done. And, you know, it must have been quite a ways into research. I kind of had to slap my forehead and say, gosh. Especially when I saw this in the context of what was happening in Hollywood and Berlin and London and Paris and the major movie places of that era, and seeing it in the context of that and saying, gosh, this is quite incredible.
I mean, you're writing your acknowledgement that you started writing this in 2004, I believe.
No, I mean, I started talking about it in 2004. So I mentioned it to somebody in New York in 2004, and it had always been an idea in the back of my mind. Like, it's when somebody asked you, how long did it take you to write the book? I mean, I guess the book itself took me maybe 6 months to write, but the research and the idea started 20 years ago. You know, and it kind of sputters away in the back of your head, and it was a long research process, you know.
And it took you many places.
Yeah, it did. It did. I mean, I got a lot of information in New York at the New York Public Library. I had to go to Cambridge to find a manuscript, Cape Town, Joburg. But basically anywhere you can find something, you know, it's usually in old books in an old bookstore that you never thought would be there. And it has a line that you can use and a piece of information like that is valuable, but it's like not where you expected it to be.
And she has some amazing archival images in the book of photography and I suppose maybe little screen grabs of the actors and themselves. Where did you find that?
So, you know, he started a movie magazine, which kind of in it was much broader than a movie magazine, which was trying to imitate the movie magazines that were starting in England and America. And it became a place for him to like further his interests in other companies, but also to show off his movies and his actors and Kilani. And he also did some news stories there. I mean, they would go into like the Malay location. They would go into Frederdorp. You know, they would show the other side of Johannesburg, which was, I thought, quite daring at the time. But I don't think he really cared what other people thought about him. He would do what he wanted to do. And like, so there's this incredible record of that mostly taken by his cameraman. And so it's kind of fitting that a lot of the pictures in the book, which I think is a really good record of like what you're going to read in the book and like it and gives you kind of some the wow factor of like, wow, that actually happened. You know, there's a picture there of this incredible set that he built in 1919 in Johannesburg that was equal to anything in like Babylon or, you know, these famous movies that were being made in America. So all that time, I mean, Babylon is just a redepiction of what happened back then, but, you know, it gives you a sense.
There was a ziggurat-esque ramp as well.
Well, that's what I'm talking about. Yeah. Yeah, but let's leave that for the readers to find out.
Okay, sorry, spoiler alert. Let's talk about his son. You do devote a number of pages towards the end of the book to his only child, John, who seems, I mean, that's a book worthy of itself.
No, definitely. I mean, I don't want to get too much into John because it's a very different story and he didn't have the wherewithal to take over his father's empire. And then he disappeared to overseas and lived a life of luxury, I guess, in, you know, the Riviera and Capri. But it was kind of, it's almost like a Citizen Kane type story of this man who has this empire and then for various reasons is kind of falls apart. And so, I mean, IW's like gift was that he could control so many companies that were so disparate. And, you know, I don't think there'd been any people, if any, who could have taken over that task when he died. But it was left to his son, who was more like a bon vivant kind of wants to have a good time. And so it was kind of slowly sold off and came to, you know, I mean, even the family itself is like you'll find very few Schlesingers of his family, his line in South Africa. None, actually.
Ooh, I remembered what I wanted to ask. Archives, even though they do exist, quite a number of films are lost.
Yeah, all of them, almost. So we have an archive in Pretoria, which is very badly funded. And I think they have about 5 movies of his, which are in vaults somewhere. I don't know what the condition is. I don't even know if they know what the condition is. There is, like, happily, there's some digitizing that's starting now, started last year. And so thousands of those African Mirror newsreel segments have been digitized, which means they will be more accessible to people, which is kind of the beginning, I hope, of some kind of reawakening of people's awareness of him. Maybe the book will help as well. And you can find YouTube videos of the two spectacles, but they're very, very, very truncated versions. So if the Futrika movie was 2 hours long originally, which was massively long for that time, when movies were about 15 minutes to half an hour long, it'll maybe be half an hour, not a half an hour, about 55 minutes, 60 minutes. And the Anglo-Zulu War, which because of its incredible battle sequences was cut up and used elsewhere in other movies, and there only was like one master copy. So that master copy is now maybe 30 minutes long, which was started as 2 hours. So a lot of that footage has been lost, sadly. And, you know, we don't have the kind of restoration, we don't have money for restoration that they do overseas. So you have directors like Martin Scorsese, who is very behind restoration of movies abroad. Mm-hmm. But I mean, he's focusing on American movies, British movies, European movies, and South Africa's, you know, I mean, I've been trying to like figure out a way to alert him to this little man who lived in Johannesburg, but let's see what I can do.
Yeah, Man City of Golden Age Cinema.
Yeah, exactly. It fits in perfectly.
Did you consider that as a working title?
Yeah, thanks. I'll take it on.
Well, too late for that. Next one. So, I'm going to wrap this up now by firstly asking you, what would you like readers to take away from who Schlesinger was or remains even in our modern narrative?
I think that people become aware of what he did and the potential that he saw in South Africa, and that he saw it was this country that could do so much more, especially when it comes time in South Africa where we feel a little bit depressed and despondent about things, and like we, you know, everything's going wrong, and you know, and yet so much good comes out of South Africa, and there's so much talent, and there's so many ideas, and we say, but oh, these are South African ideas. They're like not good as American ideas or as good as English ideas or whatever. And I mean, that's not true. I mean, they are equal to, if not better than. So I think it's for people to maybe read the story as one of the many stories that prove that, that we can do as good, if not better.
My final question. If he were alive today, would he be regarded as the face of, or maybe the patron saint of, Joe Hasselberg?
You know, I think he's much bigger than Johannesburg. Hey, I really do think that he was, you know, it's just like if somebody says this is a real Joburg story, I don't really understand what that means. I feel as though that's a very insular mindset, that we must stop thinking like that, that, you know, this was the equivalent of or better than. And I think he added this other side of Johannesburg, but you know, he remains an enigma. So, I mean, to say that he created something in Johannesburg that one can feel today, I don't know. I think I like that enigma thing, though, that he added this intangible element to Joburg and why it is the way it is today.
Okay, bring out that perfume range, Enigma, a la IW. Thank you so much for listening to our episode. Thank you, Ted, for being here. Please come back to Joburg.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right. Cheers.
Thank you for listening to this episode of PageCast, brought to you by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Did you love what you heard? Don't just stop at the stories. Buy the books. Visit your favorite bookstore to grab your next read. And remember to subscribe, share, and join us again next week for more fascinating conversations. Until then, happy reading.